Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians on the land in which I live and pay my respects to elders past, present and future. That's something we do here in Australia, giving some respect to the traditional owners of this land. My name is Bede Haynes and this is the Australian and New Zealand Studies podcast, one of the channels on the New Books Network. Today, I'm interviewing James Keating, going over his book, Distant Sisters, Australasian Women and the International Struggle for the Vote, 1880 to 1914, published by Manchester University Press in 2020, in what is known as its Gender and History series. James lectures and tutors history at the University of New South Wales in Sydney within the School of the Humanities and Languages. And before commencing at UNSW, James worked as a historian at the Office of Treatment Settlements in New Zealand, and he holds an MA from the Victoria University of Wellington and a PhD from the University of New South Wales. The book, Distant Sisters, offers a new history of the connections women in Australia and New Zealand made with one another and the rest of the world, first in their pioneer pursuit of the vote and then in their struggle to sell its merits overseas. Although the Australasian suffrage campaigns occurred side by side and shared a common commitment to international outreach, this book is the first to take these parallels seriously. Recovering a forgotten regional suffrage history, it uses their stories to explore the rise of suffrage internationalism in the late 19th century and importantly to chart its political, geographic and racial limits. It covers the period 1880 to 1914. So James, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like to begin by asking how the world we live in turned out so that in 2020, James Keating came to have a book called Distant Sisters published.
How exactly the world turned out this way? It's a long and complicated trajectory. I think in terms of my own personal trajectory, I can begin there. I think that it's a case of being in the right place at the right time. So I grew up in New Zealand in the 1990s. In 1993 was the centenary of women's suffrage rights in New Zealand, which were won Māori, Indigenous New Zealand woman, as well as Pākehā, European settler woman, at the same time in 1893. 1993 was a centenary of women's parliamentary suffrage in New Zealand. And there was a real outpouring of both academic and public history at that moment. And the suffrage story became very ingrained in the sort of new New Zealand nationalism and this new story New Zealand was telling about itself. So I grew up at a moment at which suffrage almost became part of the furniture in New Zealand. So if you look on the $10 note in New Zealand today, Kate Shepherd, who's one of the foundational figures in that struggle, features on the $10 note. And if you pay much attention to New Zealand politics at all, and Australian politics too for that matter, you'll note that the granting of suffrage to women in New Zealand, all women in Australia, white women, as I think we'll get on to, is one of the foundational stories the nation tells about itself. Those centenaries occurred between 1993 in New Zealand all the way up to 2008 in Victoria. And that really gave time and space for me to come along and start to think about suffrage in a slightly different way, and to think about it both beyond the nation, so between thinking about women in Australia and New Zealand, as well as to use some of the new sources that have been digitized, both in Australia and New Zealand, and also internationally, to write a slightly different history with slightly different concerns.
I'd like to work through a few terms, get your views on what they mean. I think that will assist in understanding the balance of this interview. First of all, I'd like to know if you perceive a difference between suffrage and having the franchise, and what those differences might be, or more broadly, what those terms actually say.
Thank you. That's a good question. I guess this book is mostly concerned with parliamentary suffrage, i.e. the right to cast a vote at general elections. There are other definitions of suffrage people might use, so the right to vote for school boards, the right to vote in municipal elections in particular, but I'm talking about parliamentary suffrage rights here. I think I use the words suffrage and franchise somewhat interchangeably. Other people might disagree with me doing that. But suffrage is the word that, or simply put, the right to vote that the activists I'm writing about were using. So they refer to themselves as suffragists, as opposed to suffragettes, which is the popular term that was developed by the Daily Mail to talk about, in condescending terms, about women who began to use militant tactics in Britain in the early 20th century. So I prefer the term suffragist.
Right. Now, I'd like to run through a list of types of activity which may restrict a person's ability at least to have one vote for one voice, and just see how the book doesn't actually always cover these, but I'd like to get your understanding of how this can be thought of as part of the family of suffrage type issues in the society. So I'll run through them and let you speak. The ones I have on my list here are gerrymandering, age, when why should a person who's 16 not be able to vote, ethnicity or heritage, how that can be used, religion, citizenship, class, punishment with prisoners, how things like a two-party political system could empower or disempower a voter, political advertising, the influence of donations. These are the types of things, and compulsory voting, giving rise to what we call in Australia the donkey vote, where someone might just number a ballot form from the top of the form downwards, not actually think about what they're doing. But if someone's compelled to vote, as we are here, in some ways that disenfranchises someone who actually thinks about voting. I'd like your views on how they sit within the concept of suffrage.
Yeah, so there's a lot in that list, a lot to run through. I think some of these restrictions speak to some of the concerns in this book a little more than others. But I guess to use the comparison between somewhere like Australia and New Zealand, in both places, one of the reasons why the campaign for women's parliamentary suffrage is won relatively quickly is because universal manhood suffrage has already been granted. Although in Australia, as we note, this is the word universal is restricted by race in some colonies and not others. So unlike in Britain, where women are fighting for the vote at the same time as working class men are still excluded from voting, that campaign obviously takes much longer. So the suffrage these women were fighting for was an adult suffrage. In Australia, as we know, women are granted the right to vote and stand for federal parliament in 1902, which is 1 year after the Commonwealth of Australia is formed from the six colonies, I should say. But in one of the founding injustices of Australian political life, that right to vote is restricted on racial lines. So what it means to be an Australian citizen is that in that moment shifts from a gendered citizenship. So to be a man is to be a citizen. And people will commonly say, well, men have to serve in overseas wars and defend the nation, therefore they're entitled to vote. And that's changed to citizenship becomes a racial category. To be white is essentially to be an Australian citizen. And the suffragists were not passive bystanders in this racial construction. They often drew on racial arguments themselves in order to suggest that white women deserved the vote as opposed to undeserving men of colour in some cases. So some of the other categories here, so things like the disenfranchisement of prisoners, the suffragists that I write about weren't particularly concerned by that, but one of the things that that tells us is that suffrage is still a right that has some restrictions. Depending on if you've committed certain crimes, that right to suffrage has been removed. I know in New Zealand, one of the things that's happening at the moment is that there's a move to enfranchise some prisoners again and to kind of expand the franchise in that way. What you note about the party system is very interesting. Of course, one of the things that happens and one of the things we might get to is that even though women in a place like South Australia, for example, they win the right to vote and the right to stand for parliament at the same time, women in New Zealand had deliberately not advocated for the right to stand to parliament because they believed it might be perceived as too radical, and they believed their chances of winning the vote were greater if they took what was called the half loaf. So suffrage rights without the right to stand for parliament. Women in South Australia don't have this problem, but it takes until 1959 for them to enter parliament. And this is for a number of reasons. Firstly, suffrage movements in Australia and New Zealand are coalitions of women of different classes and different interests. After winning the vote, they split apart and begin to pursue sectional interests, whether that be Christian interests in the prohibition of alcohol and intoxicants. Some of them revert to class lines. So obviously middle-class women and working-class women have different concerns. And political parties themselves often take women's support for granted and don't place them in winnable seats. And women who decide to stand for parliament outside of the party system, I think in Australia the most famous example is Vida Goldstein in Victoria, who stands for she stands for the Senate twice and I think the House of Representatives three times in Victoria. Because she's standing outside the party system, she's never able to gain enough votes in order to win a seat in parliament.
Thank you. Now turning our attention more toward your book, one thing I gleaned from reading the book is that it seems to me that suffrage is treated as a privilege but not a right, and that those who don't actually have it, they are the ones who need to fight or lobby to become enfranchised. I want to try and understand why some groups were left out from the very beginning. For example, why did it ever come to happen that women couldn't vote? Where did that notion even come from in our ancestors, so that there's this position that women just can't vote, and for a while that just seems normal, probably for a long while?
Yeah, it's a big question. I guess the short answer would be the existence of patriarchy in Western society. So I think that if you look at a country like Britain with a very slow expansion of voting rights were traditionally linked to property ownership and property rights. And women are excluded from this because for a long time they were excluded from owning property. So either they women were daughters of fathers who held those property rights, and if they managed to accrue their own property or capital, if you like, that are automatically transferred to the husband upon marriage. There are obviously exceptions to this. So there are women in the past who did have power, who did own property, but they were still prevented from voting. What happens in the 19th century is you see in a place like Australia, the fairly voting rights are initially restricted to property owners. I don't have the exact restrictions on the top of my head, but either to men who owned property or men who paid rent to a certain value were allowed to vote. And the idea is that this promotes stability in various ways. It also upholds entrenched interests, because obviously if everyone can vote, people are not necessarily going to vote for politicians who will prioritize the interests of the few instead of the many, if you like. Before the suffrage campaigns really take off in earnest in an organized way in Australia and New Zealand, there are campaigns for married women's property rights, for example, to allow married women to have some control over their own property. Those campaigns are won in the 1870s and 1880s, which again creates an impetus to push forward from those property rights to voting rights, if you like. As we've already touched on, one of the other major restrictions in Australia and to a lesser extent in New Zealand is along racial lines. So in New Zealand, Māori women's enfranchisement was never contested in 1893 because Māori men had already been granted the right to the vote much earlier. This is perhaps less a product of the New Zealand settlers' racial enlightenment and more a product of Māori strength within the country. So this is a country, the New Zealand Wars are fought in the 1850s. And in that moment, a series of Indigenous or Māori seats are set up, Indigenous electorates are set up. So because all Māori men are enfranchised, Māori women's enfranchisement is not contested in 1893. I should also note that the suffrage movements in Australia and New Zealand were mostly composed of white settler women who were not particularly welcoming to Indigenous women and did not particularly advocate for their rights. In New Zealand, these rights were taken for granted. And what happens is after Indigenous women are granted the right to vote in 1893, white women's organisations suddenly start to take them much more seriously because there are votes to mobilise. So the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which is one of the key organisations that advocates for the vote across Australia and New Zealand, it starts to mobilise Māori women in New Zealand as a political force to achieve their goal of prohibiting the sale of intoxicants.
I'd also like to understand, the book begins in the late 19th century, and Australia at that time was a number of colonies. It wasn't federated until 1900. What actually gave an individual within a colony, it may be different across different colonies, but broadly speaking, what did a person need to do and what was the typical profile of someone who would have the right to cast a vote at that time?
So this is before women's suffrage has been granted?
Yes.
So it varies from colony to colony. I think, as I mentioned a little earlier, initially it is males who own property to a certain value. And over the course of the 19th century, we see that property value required to vote diminishes. And also there's rights for if you rent property to a certain value, you're able to vote too. So between, in most colonies across Australasia, by about the 1870s, manhood suffrage has become universal for white men. In Australia, in some colonies, Indigenous men are able to vote as well, although these voting rights are sometimes restricted by bureaucracy and by custom as opposed to by law. And one of the arguments essentially that women make for their own enfranchisement in the colonies is that one of the great fears that settlers have is uprootedness or movement, if you like. So that they argued that actually enfranchising women will support social cohesion in the colonies because, unlike transient men who move from place to place and are a disruptive influence, they're arguing from a kind of a separate spheres ideology, which is that women will support the power of the home, the power of the settlement, and they will increase social cohesion within the colonies if they're able to vote.
As I was reading chapter one of your book, I got the impression that societal conditions tended to cultivate different suffragist cultures themselves. And the book begins with a list of abbreviations that names quite a lot, as I found, of different organisations with different, I imagine, different societal goals. Could you let me know what some of the examples of those cultures and movements were?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that's an astute observation. So I'll run through some of them. So the book is obviously a book that links, it tries to take a kind of a telescopic approach and link the lived experience of women's lives in colonial towns with big international organizations. I might start with the Women's Christian Temperance Union. As I mentioned them already, it's an organization that develops in the American Midwest, in 1872, 1873 out of the Women's Crusade, which is a movement, essentially a kind of a public movement of women going from bar to bar and trying to drag men out of bars and to shame men into reforming their drinking habits. It develops as an American national organization up into the mid-1880s under the leadership of a woman called Frances Willard, who's an incredibly charismatic leader who turns into an almost saintly figure within the organization, bearing in mind this is a Protestant organization. And in 1885, 1886, they send out their first round-the-world missionary, a woman called Mary Clement Levitt, who travels first to Hawaii and then to New Zealand and then Australia, and seeding local branches of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. So as their name implies, they're concerned with, in New Zealand and Australia, they become concerned with expanding women's political rights as a way of meeting their ultimate goal, which was the reformation of society through the prohibition of alcohol and intoxicants, particularly things like opium. Some of the other groups, the other big international groups I talk about are the International Council of Women, or the ICW, which was founded in 1888. It was envisaged as an international suffrage organization, although it quickly becomes a broad umbrella organization that has aspirations of representing all women, and it starts to insist that anti-suffragists are included within its within the organization too. This angers more radical women, who in 1902 set up the International Woman Suffrage Alliance, which is an organization that's devoted explicitly to winning women's voting rights around the world. And the Australian connection there is that the Victorian Vida Goldstein is at the inaugural meeting in Washington, D.C., and she becomes the organization's first secretary. And while she's on that international trip, she learns via mail, obviously, that she has become an enfranchised woman in Australia with the passage of the Commonwealth Franchise Act in 1902.
Thank you. With those different groups, another thing that occurred to me when reading the book was that they all had the overarching goal that the end of their action would be that women, but not all women, as we've learned, would end up with the vote. But there seems to, at least to me, to be some different reasons for that between each group. So, for example, if we think about the Women's Christian Temperance Union, one question I wanted to ask was, from reading your book, there was a concern amongst the women within that group about social issues, often within the home, gambling, alcoholism, things which could affect women, could affect children. So that wasn't, so how, for them, how was voting going to attack that? And secondly, it seems as though getting the vote must have had some, they must have thought getting the vote would give them the ability to achieve their agenda. But that wasn't so it's not necessarily the case of let's get the vote because women deserve the vote. It's rather we have an agenda about temperance and fixing things in the home. And one way to achieve that is getting the vote. And I can imagine that might be very different for other organizations who might have had a more different reason for why women should have the vote at all, irrespective of what their actual agenda was.
Yeah, yeah. So to speak about the Women's Christian Temperance Union, they did. I think that none of the groups I really talk about were interested in voting rights as the be-all and end-all. All of them saw the voting rights as a tool through which they could achieve other ends. So to use the example of New Zealand and South Australia, which is two of the places alongside New South Wales I focus on most in the book, the Women's Christian Temperance Union alone is not enough to win the vote, particularly in order to attract working-class women who are vital in the petitioning efforts and vital in mobilising large quantities of women to sign petitions, which in New Zealand is one of the chief strategies of winning the vote. They need to mobilise working-class women. To those women, temperance is not often seen as the most important goal. And one of the other things I should note is that Women's Christian Temperance Union becomes particularly focused on the vote in Australia and New Zealand. But in the United States and Britain, its manifestations are not so much focused on the vote. And this becomes a contentious issue when Women's Christian Temperance Union members from Australia and New Zealand go overseas. They find that actually the union means different things in different places. So one of the things, it's very adaptable. And One of the reasons for this is that separate suffrage organizations are much more established in Britain and the United States. And the particular Australasian version of the Women's Christian Temperance Union is much more expansive than it had been in the United States. Other groups are much more interested in equal pay, liberalizing divorce law, ending the marriage bar. Middle-class women, particularly in places like Sydney, where we are now, are interested in expanding women's access to professions, so professions like the law, for example. So there are a wide range of different goals, although what unites most of these women, at least, is the sense that the vote itself is both necessary from the point of view of democracy and equality, but also it's a necessary tool to achieve reforms. And these reforms range from moral, social, political, and economic, depending on the aims of each particular group.
And one final question about the Women's Christian Temperance Union or the Christian Temperance Unions was, I'm reminded of those types of biblical verses. You often hear things like wives submit to your husbands as to the Lord and those type of biblical directions that you often, or at least I often hear discussed. And was there any internal conflict, do you think, within these organizations that women having the vote somehow might have conflicted with their Christian beliefs?
Yeah, there is actually a lot of internal conflict. So the Women's Christian Temperance Union is kind of guided by two maxims in this period. One is this idea of home protection. So this idea that the goal of the union is to protect the home from some of the various ailments you mentioned earlier. And the other one is its American leader Frances Willard's idea of do everything. And over the course of the late 19th century and the early 20th, up until her death in the late 19th century, she gradually expands Do Everything to become a fairly advanced Christian socialist agenda over which there's increasing conflict. There's a couple of examples of this playing out in the book. I'll give one Australian example and one international example. So the Australian example is the Australian Women's Christian Temperance Union leader, Elizabeth Nicholls, a South Australian, spends much of the late 19th century, the 1890s, constantly traversing Australia on these trips, which are both intended to support federation because she believes that federation is the best chance for women to achieve this ideal of a Christian nation free from alcohol and intoxicants. And so she's constantly traveling across Australia from colonial cities to small country towns, and she's traveling on her own. She has a husband back in South Australia, and within the union itself, there's a kind of a certain nervousness about this. So people are always joking about the fact that if on the stage she mentioned that her husband Alfred is back home in Adelaide, there are kind of jokes from the audience about it. The audience are constantly thanking Alfred for his generosity in allowing Elizabeth to travel across Australia. We should note that Alfred was a very firm supporter of Nicholls' work. And critics, mostly male critics of Nicholls, are making snide jokes in the press about the fact that she's quote-unquote wearing the trousers, if you like. So, and ultimately this does come to a head within the union, and her tenure ends in 1903, I think, at a Women's Christian Temperance Union national conference, where she's replaced by a Tasmanian called Jessie Rook. And Rook, before accepting the presidency from Nicholls, who was also contesting it, says that she has to wait for a telegram from her husband in order to accept the presidency. And there's this moment, which would have been very galling to Nicholls, I think, whereby they elect Rook as the new president, but they have to wait for several hours for a telegram from Rook's husband allowing her to take the presidency with the proviso that she never has to leave Launceston. So there's a kind of a tension within the union between the stability of the home and the fact that it's a missionary organization that is based on these kind of feats of traveling missionaries. And why Nicholls proved so challenging is because she's, unlike most of these missionaries, she's a married woman with children. To use the international example I mentioned, in from between 1887 and 1892, Francis Willard, who's based in Chicago, authorizes the building of a large office building in the center of Chicago called the Woman's Temple. And this is seen by her critics as a kind of a sign that she's outstepped the middle-class focus on home and family to which the union was based. So Willard's idea was that she describes it, I think I've got the quote somewhere in the book, that the temple would be the union's Westminster Abbey and West Point and gold mine all in one. So it would both function as a school for sending these missionaries around the world. They would collect rents, which would fund this operation. And it would also serve as a kind of a grand gesture that the Women's Christian Temperance Union belonged in the heart of commercial Chicago. What happens is that the building runs into financial difficulties, and as soon as Willard dies in 1897, the union immediately divests itself of the building and returns to a much more narrow focus. So there's this constant tension between, we might call them liberals or radicals within the Christian Temperance Union, who have a kind of a Christian socialist vision, and conservatives who have a much more traditional notion of a woman's place in society. Both groups think that the vote is important, but they have different goals and ambitions. And over the time span of this book, those contradictions play out in interesting ways, I think.
And when anyone has the chance to look at this book, there is a picture of that building in Chicago, and it seems an incredibly impressive building for a group like this to have constructed. Now, one thing that grated to my ears when reading through this book was that certain people were excluded from being able to vote based on things such as ancestry, heritage, or skin colour. And we've touched on that. But one thing that seems strange to me is it seems that that omission might not have been obvious to the people at the time. It was hidden in plain sight, as the cliche goes. I'd like to ask you about that. And one example I would also like you to comment on, later in the book, you refer to a lady called Louisa Lawson, and she's working for this magazine. I think it was called Dawn. And I'm going to ask a few questions about those magazines later or news bulletins later. In any case, Louisa Lawson in 1897 reminds missionaries who were going overseas, bound for Asia, it says, that Aboriginal women deserved the first claim upon our beneficence. And then, despite her insistence that white women had a duty to honour their womanhood as we honour our own, and there was also a reference to people stealing the country from the Aboriginal people, but then there doesn't seem to be much, no one else seems to really talk about that in these publications, and you even say it doesn't really come up again until 1900 when Louisa Lawson makes another comment on it, but this time it has much less fire in it. It's just about, she requests the best droll saying by an Australian Aboriginal rather than reminding people about stolen land. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so I think the reason why I inserted those two quotes is to kind of note the surprising radicalism of Lawson's statement about Australian women's duties with that kind of later turn to a usual set of racist tropes. So one of the things I note in this book is that a lot of the people I write about end up traveling to the United States, people like Catherine Helen Spence, the South Australian reformer and feminist, Vida Goldstein, as I've mentioned. Elizabeth Nichols does not travel to the US, but she travels to Edinburgh, where she works alongside an African-American woman from Louisiana. And what's common is that encounters with African-American women and their struggles in the United States, another woman, Wilhelmina Sheriff Bain from New Zealand, makes the same point, engender a kind of a sense of solidarity with those struggles, but they are universally unable to kind of transpose that sense of racial solidarity with racial injustices going on in Australia and New Zealand. Nichols, again, is a good example. So she spends most of the 1890s traveling across Australia, and she writes these exhaustive travel accounts in the WCTU's magazine, Our Federation. And what's clear if you read them is that she never mentions an Indigenous person ever. And this kind of corresponds with white settler strategies of rendering the Australian landscape empty, therefore justifying settler expansion. So sometimes an example of the ways in which suffragists deployed race in New South Wales would be that Some Indigenous men were able to vote in New South Wales in the 1890s, and Rose Scott and the Womanhood Suffrage League constantly make the point that how come what they refer to as black fellows are able to vote, but white women are unable to vote. So they're kind of deploying race as a, they're calling for white racial solidarity as a reason to enfranchise white women. I think what unites all of these women is that they're all settler colonists who are unable to see themselves as racial oppressors, if you like. So when they Nichols is interesting because at the same time as she's carefully excluding any mention of Indigenous people from her tours across country Australia, she also celebrates the WCTU as an example of racial solidarity in practice. Australia is unusual in the fact that, so in New Zealand, Māori women are included within the WCTU, often within separate Māori branches. In other parts of the world, the WCTU is complicated because it's both a critic of some of the excesses of colonialism at the same time as it's is a beneficiary of colonialism. So it it thrives in what we might call the British world and the British Empire, so places British India, for example, and it includes women of colour in its activism, never as leaders, but Nichols, despite celebrating this, is unable to see the fact that it's incongruous that the WCTU does not include Indigenous women at the centre of its own activism in Australia. And we might see that the decision to enfranchise white women and to disenfranchise all Indigenous people in Australia not to be surprising once we see that the suffragists either tacitly or overtly used those own logics in their own campaigns.
One interesting aspect of the book is these women you've been speaking of left these countries in the Southern Hemisphere and endured travelling over to the Northern Hemisphere to meet and discuss these matters. It seems, and I'd like you to comment on this, that the way in which these people were treated, and I'm thinking of Catherine Spence and Kate Shepherd, or two, some notes I've made about, was that the way in which their achievements, or women's achievements to get the vote, was treated by those overseas seems a little bit unusual to me. For example, they're often referred to as being of interest to people in Britain because these were social experiments and people were somehow interested in what would happen in these old colonies to these, or they were probably still colonies then in some cases, to these women or to these democracies where these women were able to get the vote. Another thing, another issue I noted was there seems to have been a notion that a sort of myth that that when women did get the vote, it was just gifted to them by the men rather than being fought for. I think there's an example you give in New Zealand where that was a common characteristic, a common understanding, the myth of the New Zealand government gifting the vote to women without actual pressure or activism from women. And there also seems to have been an idea that giving the Maori women the vote was in some ways a mistake because it was given, it would just show, well, they're giving these, the only reason these people get the vote is because they have a lack of a proper education and they don't come from cosmopolitan cities. Who else would you give the vote to? Just give it to anyone down there. It doesn't really matter. Could you comment on that?
Yeah. There's a lot there. I think that so the book starts with a set of declarations that the suffragists make between 1893 and 1908. That it starts with this moment whereby they celebrate their pioneer victories by making explicit their claims about leading the world. So the idea is that they're not just winning the vote for their own benefit, but they feel indebted to women, particularly in Britain and the United States, and they feel indebted to those women. And there's a sense that suffrage internationalism behooves them to carry on the struggle in other places. Both Kate Shepherd and Catherine Spence find that they're much, particularly Spence, finds that she's much better received in the United States than she is in Britain. So Spence travels to the United States in 1893. She's in her mid-60s, and she spends an entire year traveling across the US and making a living as a journalist and a lecturer. She lectures a lot on proportional representation, on what she calls the boarding out system, so systems of fostering children rather than putting them in state institutions. And she increasingly lectures on suffrage because being a suffrage speaker in the US at this point in time is still a viable career. So speakers are paid, unlike in Australia and New Zealand. And she goes to Britain and she talks about finding herself strangely unable to speak there. Shepherd finds the same thing. So she's of Scottish ancestry. She grew up partly in Liverpool and she moved to New Zealand as a settler. After winning the vote in 1894 and 5, Shepherd travels back to the UK, and this is often framed as a triumphal tour, if you like, of her going back and selling suffrage to the British and teaching them a lesson. What happens there is she finds that British women she meets are friendly, but there's a sense that she's tainted by a certain kind of colonial naivete. And the problem she has is that to the British, she doesn't seem much like a suffragist. So there's these two moments which, as someone who finds public speaking to be difficult, I very much sympathize with. There's a moment on the stage in front of over 1,000 people at the Queen's Hall in London, in which this is one of her first public appearances in London. She appears with the New Zealand, the former New Zealand Prime Minister and the chief parliamentary campaigner for women's suffrage, Sir John Hall, and reports variously suggest that her voice was inaudible, and she suffers a kind of a breakdown upon the stage. A second breakdown occurs about a year later at the World's Women Christian Temperance Union Conference in London. And there's this paradox she suffers where she's unable to exemplify the virtues of New Zealand women's suffrage from the stage. She's unable to speak to large audiences. So she's unable to combat the gift narrative, which is propagated by people like the New Zealand Agent General in London, a man called William Pember Reeves, whose book, State Experiments in Australia and New Zealand, explicitly frames suffrage as a gift given by beneficent liberal politicians like him to women, rather than a right that woman had to fight organized campaigns for. And so Shepherd is unable to use her speech to combat that narrative. And this is kind of how the gift narrative propagates, is that Pember Reeves' book is not actually that popular in Australia and New Zealand, but it sells incredibly well in Britain and the United States. And Reeves himself becomes the first head of the London School of Economics, a very influential figure within the Fabian School in London. And Reeves's articulation is the one that's allowed to live, despite suffragists using various kinds of media, their own publications, writing for magazines, writing news articles. And in fact, Shepherd herself commissions a man who would later become her husband to write a book, a man called William Sidney Smith, outlining the struggle to combat the gift narrative. But it takes until the 1970s and the emergence of women's liberation and women's history in Australia and New Zealand for the gift narrative to finally be put to rest.
I'd like you to comment now on the publications that you run through. There were a lot of women's advocacy newspapers published between 1888 and 1910. And one thing that surprised me about these was that they weren't particularly long, most of them. Some of them might only be one or two pages long. And the print runs were quite small. Some only had circulations of a few hundred subscribers, and some only had a few thousand. So I'd like to understand the influence those publications had and their purpose, and whether they were preaching to the choir or whether they actually went further and would draw in people who didn't think themselves aligned with this cause to only become aligned with the cause.
Yeah, so I think one of the chapters of the book really focuses on the suffrage press. I think what's interesting about it to me is that, just as you note, the sheer number of newspapers. Australia and New Zealand had much higher rates of newspaper publication than Britain did at this moment. As you note, these publications are often quite small, I think, although Dawn is perhaps an exception. Louisa Lawson's Dawn is much longer. It's more of a magazine than a newspaper. The print runs are often quite short. Some of them only last for a couple of years. I think they exist for a number of reasons. One is to report on the activities, the ambitions, the desires of suffragists in a way that wasn't accessible in other forms of media, which would report on suffrage meetings, but would not report sympathetically on suffragists or give them enough space for them to document these ambitions and desires. So a newspaper exists to bring movements together. In Australia and New Zealand, they're important because suffragists are scattered in, particularly in New Zealand, I think, where suffragists are scattered between a range of towns. There's no one hub for the movement, if you like. And as well, these newspapers exist to disseminate news of events, activities, ideas from Australia and New Zealand to the rest of the world. So this is a moment in which the scissors and pay system of journalism is still very much in effect, whereby each newspaper often has a list of about 50 newspapers where they share free copies of. They cut and paste different news items from those newspapers into their own publications. So by reporting, say, an example of a newspaper like Dawn, for example, in Sydney, by reporting on women's suffrage activities in Sydney, it's also being extracted and clipped and reported on in women's newspapers across the world. So it's both, it's communicating with different audiences at the same time. It's, I guess it creates an imagined community, to use that Benedict Anderson phrase, around the movement itself. So these newspapers both allow women who don't necessarily see prominent suffrage leaders, someone like a Rose Scott in New South Wales or a Kate Shepherd in New Zealand, that that there is a community of interests here. These newspapers are often read aloud and shared at meetings. So even though their print runs were small, they had a much wider circulation informally. And they exist to share news of suffrage and women's struggles in Australia and New Zealand to newspapers across the world through this scissors and paste system. And one of the things that I found in this book is that these newspapers circulated in a Tasman market. So there was New Zealand subscribers to newspapers from New South Wales and Victoria. There were Australian subscribers, slightly less actually, to New Zealand women's newspapers. And I think one of the things I do is I break these newspapers down by content as well to see where the news was actually coming from and to kind of trace the contours of internationalism, if you like. So one of the things we see is that a kind of a village and globe approach is perpetuated, whereby there's lots of news about the places a newspaper is from. So Prohibitionist, which is one of them in Christchurch in New Zealand, focuses a lot on Christchurch, not that much on the rest of New Zealand, and news particularly from the United States and Britain. The same is true of somewhere, Dawn in New South Wales, Australian Women's Fair in Melbourne. And also the limits of the Australasian suffrage world I talk about are quite clear. And these limits are based on who else has a newspaper, really. So New Zealand, South Australia, Queensland, not so much actually, New South Wales, Victoria, these kind of eastern colonies, if you like, are at the centre of this world, and places without a woman's newspaper almost entirely ignored. So Western Australia, Queensland, Tasmania. And I try to qualify some exuberant claims about the internationalism of these papers that some people make. So one of the things that you often see in this in each of these newspapers is a kind of a composite column which includes little snippets and little references of kind of positive stories about women across the world. They're often given titles like Chit Chat or From Here and There. And these are often kind of deracinated stories which speak to women's achievements in various places, but often out of context, if you like. And they wouldn't necessarily have given readers a kind of a global sense of the fortunes, prospects and ambitions of organized women in different parts of the world. And of course, one of the things that hinders these women I'm writing about and me, one of the things that hinders my own research a little bit, which I'm a little embarrassed to say, is language. So most of the women I talk about, with few exceptions, were monoglot. They were mostly English speakers. So there's stories of them exchanging newspapers with Elizabeth Nichols, exchanges newspapers with a Norwegian woman's newspaper called Det Hvite Band, which I think means the white ribbon in Norwegian. And she kind of notes a bit dryly that she's unable to read the newspaper, so she can't share news from Norway in her own newspaper because she can't read it, and she asks if any of her own readers are able to translate for her. So one of the limitations is, of course, you have to be able to read French, German, Italian, if you want to include news from those places in any kind of systemic way.
Two questions to finish up. The first is, as a historian, I'd like to get some understanding from you as to how you get a sense of the day-to-day lives of the people you're writing about and their movements. You have the written records, but how do you take the further step of actually understanding how life was like? We're talking 100 years ago. How do you delve into that detail?
It's a very tricky question. I think that there's a couple of ways about it. One is to read as much about a period that other historians have written and try and immerse myself in that period. I think that the rise of digitized newspapers has been both a blessing and a curse, a blessing in the sense that we can find out so much more about people, particularly women. One of the things you can do now is you can find a name and search around and then find both a first and a last name, which is not as easy as you might think. But at the same time, I think it's perhaps made people a little less attentive to archival records. So one of the things I really try and do in this book is to conjure up everyday experiences of internationalism. And where you find these is through the records and minutes of organizations like the Women's Christian Temperance Union, like the Womanhood Suffrage League in New South Wales. Every meeting is reported on in detail. These are obviously reductive written accounts of ephemeral conversations, but they build up and accrete a sense of the daily aspects of suffrage internationalism. So some newspapers publish reading lists of books they are recommending people read. Within the Women's Christian Temperance Union, there were everyday aspects of internationalism. So they had a thing called the noontide prayer hour. The idea is that the world would be constantly encircled by women praying at a certain hour of the day. Shared rituals like reading literature aloud. Also, they would often read the same scripture passages at the same time of year. They would sing the same songs. One of the other ways you can trace it is things through the collection exchange of photographs as kind of material signifiers of internationalism. But also there are limits to this too. So none of the women I wrote about kept a detailed diary. When I was talking about Shepherd's, these two instances of her breakdown on the stage, with Shepherd it's a bit more complicated because I understand that there are some personal papers which the family have not released, but I don't know exactly how she felt about that. I can only try and empathize as much as possible upon understanding that the experience of being a white middle-class woman from New Zealand in the 1890s is quite removed from my own. But I guess the goal is to read as far as the documents allow you, and then there is a kind of an imaginative leap you have to take. Recent historians of African-American women like Sadia Hartman have shown, this leap is much more necessary for some women than for others. So I'm lucky in that there's actually a real wealth of information for me to go on. So someone like Catherine Spence, she constantly sort of goes over and over again her United States tour. But actually, she does have a diary, which is lucky. But she writes letters to other women about it 10 years later, and she might have changed some of the details. But there's a real wealth of documents that I can extrapolate out from. And I think combining organizational minutes, personal letters, newspapers together, you can approximate a certain sense of what daily life was. But I think it's important that I'm aware that there are some aspects of these lives that might be quite difficult for me to understand too. And I hope I haven't overstretched the limits in the book.
And finally, James, could you please let us know what projects you are now working on?
Right now I'm working on several projects actually. So the first is extending some of the arguments in this book in a different way. One of the arguments in this book is, I think the two overarching arguments in this book are, the first is an attempt to look at the dynamics of this emerging international feminist movement from the perspective of people from a geographically marginal, although ideologically influential region, Australia and New Zealand. And the second goal of the book is to decenter the way that the nation has kind of dominated suffrage history in Australia and New Zealand. So one of the things I'm working on is thinking about Dora Meeson Coates' famous Trust the Woman banner, which was purchased by the Australian Federal Parliament in 1988 and hangs there now. And the very fact of that purchase has kind of made it an Australian artifact. Even though, as I argue, Meeson Coates spent most of her youth and kind of formative years as an artist and a suffrage activist in New Zealand, and then spent most of her adulthood in Britain, and trying to think about her as an Australasian figure rather than an Australian figure, what that does. My second bigger project is focusing on the 20th century, particularly an international feminist group called Equal Rights International, and the influence of a Sydney group called the United Associations of Women within Equal Rights International, and this particularly the promotion of an Australian idea of incomes for wives internationally. Incomes for wages for housework is commonly understood as one of the mainstays of women's liberation in the 1970s, but my new project is about thinking about earlier manifestations, arguments for economic payment for wives and mothers, who should pay for this labour, and these early arguments about putting an economic value on women's domestic labour as a way of giving it value within capitalist economies, and how these ideas developed in a particular way in Sydney and Australia, and how women like Linda Littlejohn and Jessie Street sold them abroad in the 1930s and 1940s.
Thank you, James. Thank you for your time. This has been the Australian and New Zealand Studies Channel, a podcast on the New Books Network. And today we have had an engaging conversation with James Keating concerning his book, Distant Sisters, Australasian Women and the International Struggle for the Vote, 1880 to 1914, from Manchester University Press. And I understand it's still forthcoming, but it should be published relatively soon. Thank you very much, James. Speak to you soon.
Slight correction. It is out now. It came out, I think, possibly at the end of September. So, do ask your library to buy it or check it out if you can. And thanks again, Bede, for taking the time. I really enjoyed it.